Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Human trafficking isn't simply limited to sex trafficking. People are also trafficked for labor. The history of human trafficking is a long, complicated one, one that's shaped by race and discrimination. One could look at the Mann Act of 1910. It was known as the White Slave Traffic Act. The law made it a crime to transport women, white women specifically, across state lines for immoral purposes such as sexual slavery and prostitution. Meanwhile, women in Texas at the time were not seen as victims in need of rescue. Mexican and Chinese trafficking survivors were still denied citizenship or legal status, and the Mann Act was also used to target individuals based on their race or political beliefs. The law that defines human trafficking in the U.S. today dates back to 2000. Under the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act, survivors must prove they were victims of a severe form of trafficking. They must also help prosecute their trafficker. The trafficked person must also be fearful of retaliation. One must be a perfect victim. Dr. Annie Isabel Fukushima is an assistant professor in the Ethnic Studies Division in the School for Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah. Fukushima is the author of Migrant Crossings, Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S. Fukushima says Migrant Crossings examines the complicated history of the anti-trafficking movement and the racist, colonialist history that shaped trafficking laws, particularly how they impact Asian and Latino migrants.
When I do the work of writing and focusing on human trafficking and migrant crossings, focused on the experiences of immigrants, in particular from Asian and Latin America that are trafficked in the United States, that for me, it was an important journey to grapple with a particular topic that is about violence. But when we think about trafficking, it is not just in isolation by itself. It is connected to so many other social issues. Social issues such as food access, housing access, labor rights, rights around our bodies and sexuality, racism, and the list goes on. And so for me, Migrant Crossings is not just to talk about trafficking, but to talk about a range of social issues that are 21st century concerns. And I'm always asked, if I see trafficking, what should I do or how do I get involved? And it's such a complicated question to answer because on the one hand, I'm very cautious around the sort of rescue narrative and how people are always quickly compelled to rescue the other. Some people, right? And so I think that for me, though, that there is the important work of coalition, though. And so we do need in movements, in social justice movements, people working to address things that create the conditions of abuse. And so for me to do anti-trafficking work might be to work directly with anti-trafficking organizations, but it also might be to take up on social justice issues, such as the list that I raised around immigrant rights, housing rights, food rights, and anti-racism, even, you know, indigenous rights. And so I hope that in reading Migrant Crossings, that people see the complexities of the issues and see that there is multiple ways in which people can be involved in addressing things that happen to people, traumatic events that happen to people that create the conditions of abuse.
Can you give us some more examples of how Latinos and Asians are folded into labor trafficking and how discrimination fits so much into that fold?
So When we think about the history of work in the United States, what we know is that during slavery, there were economies that were relegated, racist economies that were relegated to Black, Native, and Brown bodies, and even Asian bodies. And this included working in agriculture industry and domestic work. And we can see that even in the labor protections, such as the Fair Labor Standard Act, these communities were left out from protections or full protections, and it took years of advocating, even decades of advocating from community organizers to change that. You know, when we think about the Bracetto programs, no one blinked an eye when they would see agriculture workers stooping over for 14 hours, right, working without breaks, living in horrible conditions, unlivable conditions, which we still see. And so the labor trafficking is just any kind of industry in which a person's labor is being extracted. So this includes informal economies to formal economies. So hotel work, janitorial work, including, you know, forced scams, forced drug sales. Even I'm seeing cases of forced human smuggling. There's a whole gamut in which a person can labor and be abused or trafficked in it through force, fraud, or coercion. And we see a range of cases in the United States that occur here. And in particular, the racism towards particular communities is that it's oftentimes assumed that those are the industries that they should labor in for even just experiencing labor violations, from poor wages to unpaid work to even working without breaks.
Yeah, and it could be easily argued that the government has facilitated a lot of these slave-like industries. Like you were mentioning the braceros, domestic work and agriculture work is not protected under law as far as wage protections go. And of course, those are all, for the most part, minority and or immigrant workers. So can you go into a little bit more? You talked about braceros, and actually, it's still a process that's going on right now. In the wake of COVID-19, we have been seeing the government allowing more migrant labor to come in to help work on the fields at less than livable wages.
I think that one of the things that what we know about workers that work in industries that are so vital to what we need to live, such as food industries from, you know, farm to table, is that what we see is that a lot of workers and communities of color, in particular migrant communities, as well as communities who are part of the working poor, are the ones who work in those industries and will go and work in them in the face of harm, being exposed possibly to pandemic or COVID-19. What we know about human trafficking is that when there aren't protections, such as labor protections, you couple that with racism, what that does is it just creates these sort of conditions that are ripe for abuse. And so what we are seeing is that in the United States, there is, you know, a relegation of agriculture workers to labor and work, not necessarily having the protective coverings. One of the things that is also concerning is not only the conditions of workers, but if they are experiencing abuse, if everyone is sheltering in place, it was already prior to pandemic difficult to access communities that were isolated in rural areas because of language, because of geography. And so then the question becomes, how are those communities doing now in a time where many people are sheltering in place, and it's becoming even more difficult to access and connect with communities. I think the other thing that's concerning is during pandemic is the treatment of migrants at the border, in which many of them are seeking asylum in the United States because they have been trafficked or experienced other forms of violence, from sexual assault to family abuse to, you know, threats of death. The list goes on. And so for in this moment in which we aren't allowing entry, and even more so, the United States government is making it difficult for trafficked people to access legal relief, then that means that it puts them in even more dangerous conditions where they may not even try to seek the small relief that the United States has, such as a trafficking visa, a T visa. That's what we're kind of seeing in this moment. And I think that for communities, migrant communities, communities of color, there are resources. It's just that in this moment, there's all these sort of conditions that might make it more difficult to access it. And so what we know is that the standards to receive these kinds of relief are really high and really difficult. And so for me, when I think of survivors who are receiving a T visa or going to apply for it, they have to have an airtight case. And in a way, one of the things that we've seen is they also have to participate in being seen as this sort of what I call in the book, a perfect victim. If you're not a perfect victim, you know, somebody who seeks out the authorities, somebody who is seen as perfectly innocent and not contradictory, you know, if you're not seen as those things, then it might mean that you might not be seen as a trafficked person, when in reality, it is not about your innocence that makes you trafficked. It's about the conditions of abuse. We know that people can participate in a range of things from visa fraud because they're forced to by their abusers, or participate in illicit economies because if they don't, the worst thing that would happen to them is they'll die, or other kinds of abuse, threats to loved ones or themselves. And so, you know, I think that when I think of the T visa and the low authorizations and the low numbers of people receiving T visas, it's an indication of how difficult it is to get and how the standards of, you know, being seen as a trafficked person, the standards of being seen as that quote unquote perfect victim are quite high.
So you point out in your book, many of these trafficking survivors often engage in criminal activity themselves, for example, prostitution. For one, like you mentioned before, it's so hard to meet the standards that are defined by law. And even though, you know, you may see in traffic rest stops or truck stops, there's signs there for if you're a victim of trafficking, call this number or go to this website. Do you think that trafficking survivors are still encouraged to take action to save themselves? Or do you think that they might see themselves as just running into a brick wall with no chance for progress?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that the examples that you raise around these campaigns to raise visibility and resources, the challenges, is that on the one hand, many of these signs are in English, right? And if you are a migrant worker in the United States and English is not your preferred language, you may not even be reading those signs and understand that there is a resource for you. And oftentimes these signs are created in dominant languages such as Spanish or Chinese or, you know, languages that we're more likely to see more people speaking. But that leaves out so many indigenous languages that people speak and is their preferred language. And so, you know, on the one hand, there's a language thing. But then, you know, on the other hand, there is, when people are surviving, oftentimes they may not see themselves as experiencing abuse because it's been normalized. These things are seen as the norm and how one survives. And they don't know that there are resources and that there's a maybe even another way. The other hand is that, you know, if you have to pay for food and if you have childcare or you have family members that you are taking care of, and many migrant communities may have extended family members that they're taking care of where they're sending home remittances back home to their countries. And so finding work is really important. And you know, sustaining themselves is really important. And so whatever that might mean, whether it's working under the table in domestic work, in a restaurant, or even in the illicit industries, people will survive, do what they need to do to survive.
Dr. Annie Isabel Fukushima is an assistant professor in the Ethnic Studies Division in the School for Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah. Fukushima is the author of Migrant Crossings: Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S. When we come back, Dr. Fukushima argues for unsettled witnessing in the anti-human trafficking movement.
Or people really getting on the ground and doing the work, that there has been a normative way of seeing this, seeing what's happening. And so for me, it's important that we complicate that.
More with Annie Isabel Fukushima next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. When it comes to human trafficking, who is defined as a victim? Who is defined as a criminal? It's not as cut and dried as you think. A human trafficking survivor can be engaged in criminal behavior like prostitution or drug dealing. a person who may be prosecuted for trafficking may him or herself be a victim working under the threat of violence or death. Witnesses hold the key to whether a trafficking survivor can jump through social and judicial hurdles to receive protections or whether a trafficker will see justice. Dr. Annie Isabel Fukushima maneuvers through the complicated web of victimhood and criminality of trafficking in her book Migrant Crossings, Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S. Fukushima herself has served as a witness in trafficking cases. She argues that witnessing isn't simply passive, it's active and must be unsettled.
On the one hand, we can see witnessing as like we're spectators at a distance, seeing something on the news. Or, you know, there's witnesses that are the witnesses to events. And so these might be folks who are there when things happen, whether they're community members or even the self-witness, right? I myself experiencing something. So witnessing is quite complex in that sense. And one of the things that I was and have been troubled with in writing and thinking through when I was working in community organizations is that I was troubled with that in order for somebody to be seen as a human, we had to focus on the most dire aspects of their experience. But survivors of events laugh, they're complicated, they have a whole range of things that they may experience and even may experience joy even in the most abusive of conditions. We are a complicated species, but that doesn't mean that trafficking did not happen. And so one of the things that I appeal to the reader then as well is to enact an unsettled witnessing, and that is to be unsettled with what one is seeing, to raise questions about aspects of events, to pay attention to performance in institutions. And here I'm thinking about legal institutions, but also even institutions such as the nonprofit industry, government-based institutions, and educational institutions, and to examine the politics of representation as the sort of last thread of thinking through and enacting an unsettled witnessing. And for me, we need to enact new forms of witnessing to understand the phenomenon of human trafficking, because the way that we have been seeing and witnessing, and you know, whether you are looking at an experience from a distance and being called to actions, which might be inaction to do nothing or to do something about it, you know, whether it's click a button or donate money or what have you, the range goes on, or people really getting on the ground and doing the work, that there has been a normative way of seeing this, seeing what's happening. And so for me, it's important that we complicate that. And this is really informed by theories in women of color theories, transnational feminisms, and decolonial feminisms. These theories are really helping me to understand what it means to enact an unsettled witnessing.
Has witnessing taken a hit because of COVID-19? For example, I'm thinking COVID has brought to the surface a lot of inequities as far as health and economies in the minority communities, Black and Latino, for example. But it's also buried a lot of other topics. We hear of child abuse cases. The reports of child abuse have gone down, but that doesn't mean that they have necessarily decreased. They're just not being reported. Do you think that's happening as well with trafficking? You know, we're all sort of in this sheltering state of mind that we're not really looking to see what is actually going on around us in the shadows already.
Right. That's a really great question. I'm actually doing a study with some colleagues at the University of Utah on domestic violence and COVID-19, so how shelter-in-place policies impact domestic violence. And here we're understanding domestic violence as any form of violence that occurs in the home, from child abuse, elder abuse, to intimate partner violence and human trafficking. And I think that one of the things that shelter-in-place policies do is it does make it more difficult. Less people are going to hospitals, which would be another way that somebody might have asked certain questions that would have then connected a person to resources if they'd been experiencing some form of abuse. Teachers, educators from K through 12 to even the college level were important connections to resources for people who might be experiencing abuse. And so I do think that in this moment of sheltering in place, we are seeing unique conditions that did not happen before. It is definitely, as you pointed out, exposing a lot of the inadequacies in our current infrastructure. And so we have known that about our immigration infrastructure. We've known that about labor industries as well as a housing system. And so we're seeing a lot of those sort of different structures buckle in the face of pandemic.
So how has the prosecution of trafficking cases been affected by COVID? Because there's a lot of courts that are not meeting in session. There are juries that are not being able to be put together because the courtrooms are shut down. We have to socially distance. What has been your observation?
Yeah, that's really hard for survivors of human trafficking who have legal cases that they want to move forward with, right, in the criminal and civil systems, and even in family law. And so we're seeing a lot of that being put on hold, which means that for survivors not only having to deal with the trauma of living in pandemic, they're still holding on to the history of trauma and not know what is going to happen. I'm an expert witness on a case, and we just don't know when things will happen and how it will look, right? Things are still to be determined in some court systems.
Dr. Annie Isabel Fukushima is an activist and scholar. She's an assistant professor in the Ethnic Studies Division in the School for Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah. Fukushima is the author of Migrant Crossings, Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Brie Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Ben Henry is our podcast producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.